You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between. And today we're going to help fill in those blanks for the things in between with a very special guest, probably the only guest we've had so far who has a Wikipedia page dedicated to her. So welcome to Buildopedia, Caroline Pidcock. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. Great pleasure to be here.
And I think the thing that I wanted to say is that I've known about, as opposed to, I guess, a lot of people that we chat to who are friends doing us favors, I've heard a lot about you. I've followed your career. I've followed a lot of initiatives, but until now, I've never really connected. But you're definitely someone that I've admired for a long time and taken a lot of inspiration from. Caroline, one of the things we do is tell our listeners about someone or something that's inspired us. So I know you're keen to tell me about someone who inspired you.
Well, I went to a play at the Sydney Theatre Company this week called Julia, which is about Julia Gillard. And it's her story about where she came from, what shaped her, and what happened to her as Prime Minister. And I was just totally re-inspired about how graciously and determinedly she dealt with some really crap stuff coming at her. And she just continued on and didn't lose it and just kept doing what she thought was right. And she got through a record 570 pieces of legislation, more than any other government before her and probably since, in her time as Prime Minister. Even though she was on a tenderhook, because she negotiated respectfully and carefully with everyone, and she just kept going regardless of what was coming at her. And gosh, it was terrible that what did. And I just thought, wow, that is inspiring, because I think often we can feel that the world is against us and we just give up, but she didn't. And I think that's important.
Okay. Well, I didn't prepare anyone who inspired me, but I think, like, Caroline, you've inspired me. Like, you really have. You're someone I've looked up to for a long time. And I think it's just about your tenacity, and you're always there chipping away. And that's what resonates. So, Caroline, you're the first guest to not only to have your own Wikipedia page, but you're the first actual real life person that's inspired me that we've had on the podcast. So,
thank you, Matt. I feel that's really lovely to hear. Thank you.
And I guess in terms of your back, you've got a stellar career, and you've been in so many initiatives, and you've been, I think, president of the New South Wales chapter of Architects, Institute of Architecture. But I was going to ask, like, what is the thing that you're really most proud of in your career? Like, what is that thing that we should all know about?
I think the thing I'm most proud about is that I've been able to keep updating and changing what I'm doing as I find evidence that I need to change. So what prompted me to start my own practice was, it was accidental. I didn't plan it. And then suddenly there I was with a practice. And a friend recommended I do a small business course, because guess what? I had a small business. And at that course, you had to do a business plan. And in that business plan, there was this question: what's your unique selling point? And I looked at that question. I thought, gosh, that's going to be really important in defining the sorts of clients I attract, the sorts of projects I attract. And I had no idea what that was. And so I kept looking for that for months. And I can still remember walking into REL Bookshop in Paddington and finding this book, Green Architecture by Robert and Brenda Vale. and pulling it off the shelves and going, oh my God, I think this is it. This is it. And I literally took it home, read it overnight and went, wow, this is what I want to do. And the next day I thought, well, how do I become an expert in this? And I saw an advertisement advertising for someone to lecture at the University of Newcastle, and the fine print was develop curriculum. And I thought maybe they could pay me to stay in front of the students. Anyway, I applied and that took me in directions. I feel like my life has been a bit like sailing, where you kind of want to head over there, but the winds take you in different directions and you weave around, you end up there. But that was a crucial and fascinating place and time to be. But the thing that has happened is that I started off looking at what is green architecture, then worked out that wasn't enough. It really needed to be sustainable. And then most recently, regenerative, because I think as you find more things, you need to adapt your, what you think is, you know, you need to acknowledge that and adapt what you're doing. And I have done that and been able to do that. And I think that's something I'm pleased to be able to say I've done in my career.
And to me, like Caroline Pidcock is green architecture in Australia. Like that's kind of like, I don't know if that's right, but I just feel that you've been at the forefront of it for such a long time and such a champion of green architecture that I feel like you're almost the epitome of green architecture. I don't know if I'm a little bit misguided in that.
I think you're misguided, but look, it has been. I am a lot older than you probably think, and I did start that journey in 1992, and there weren't a lot of people on it at the time. And, you know, I've made some really great friends along the way who continue to be involved, and there's some amazing people who have been there for at least as long as I have. So I can't profess to be the only one, but I do have a cohort of great friends.
Maybe you're the loudest. you're the most active, because you come up again and again so many times. And I guess one of our things is that we're always inspired to be more green as a design. And you know, prior to being a designer and on an architecture practice, Ballast Point was a builder. And it's just, we always feel like there's good intention, there's commitment. It's very hard to take clients with you sometimes, because I've just found that, you know, they're all committed to green architecture and sustainability. They're just so much more committed to budget and comfort and big windows and other things.
I think that's the thing, is finding a way forward where you get all of that together and finding compelling reasons to help them understand the opportunities. I think Buckminster Fuller said, I'm not sure of the exact quote, but he basically said, you're not going to make people do things. You've got to create a better future that they want. And that's kind of the job of what we do, you know.
Yeah. And so tell us what regenerative design is.
I think one of the nicest definitions, because it's a very complex thing, you know, as anything that deals with life is, it's not a simple one-liner. But Dominique Hess, a friend of mine, explains it. She sort of says, you know, if you give someone a fish, they and their family will eat for a day. If you teach them to fish, they'll eat for their lifetime. But if you teach them to love the ocean, together they will all thrive forever. And I think it's that what regenerative design is all about is actually really understanding we are part of a much bigger system, and that if we want that whole system to thrive so that we can, we need to be looking as much outwards as inwards, and we need to be assisting the whole system to thrive. And I think that is what is kind of enlivening and energizing for me, is it really is a bigger thing than just making your own home nice. It's about contributing to the biggest nested systems within which your home and your family and your community live, and seeing how together we can all flourish and thrive together.
So if I say that, not being disrespectful, but if I said that to some of my clients, they would kind of go, that's nice, but what is it really? Yeah. Like, what do I get out of it? Like, what is it in a practical sense?
What you get out of it, what's in it for me which is seemingly the thing, is that you will thrive as nature thrives, as your community thrives, because if they don't, you won't.
Yeah, so like in a practical sense, what's the difference between a green design and regenerative design? Like what is it in a practical sense?
Okay, so say, for example, a green design, you might say, I'm living in the middle of nowhere in a house that's not connected to the electricity grid or it's not connected to the water. I'm collecting all my own power. I'm collecting all my own water, treating my own sewage, growing all my own food. And guess what? You've got to drive miles to get anything or meet up with anyone, and you're probably expending more energy on that travel and that interaction than you are saving by being all on your own and an individual. I mean, I think one of the big things is that we've got to move our mindset from a very ego me on the top of a heap of pile of nature and understanding that we are, it's an eco mindset of one being within nature and being within these other things, and finding that it's more important to help that whole group of systems do well. And I think green architecture can just be about me and my home and my family, and that's it, you know, at the most.
Yeah, and I've always been a skeptic of bush blocks and growing your veggies, and because, like, if everyone in the world did that, we wouldn't, there's not enough land, right? So
I think we can all grow our veggies. I've got some growing on my balcony here.
Sure. If you're isolated and you've got a bush block, and you know, that's great, but there's not enough bush blocks in the world for everyone to do that. And sometimes I guess, yeah, sure, you can, we're all aspire.
I think if you've got a bush, if you do have a bush block, you should be really growing something more than just for yourself. You know, it should be a regenerative farm or reforesting an area, or, you know, just sort of more than just a weekender on a beach, on a bush block. Or
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, and I think that's the key, is that when you do the maths on what the yield is typically on the average bush block, no one's really growing enough food. No, like it's, so I've always found that it's a great aspiration, but it's not a practical solution. So if everyone just grew their own veggies, there's not, without modern agriculture, there's probably not enough food. Or maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But I've always thought, well,
I think there's a whole world of beauty in regenerative agriculture that's being realised at the moment. It's probably not getting enough press. But I don't think we need industrialised agriculture to feed the world. I think we need really regenerative agriculture. But I do think it does work that there are some people who concentrate more effort on creating more food as long as it's regeneratively done. But I also believe that everyone living in the city or living in the suburbs should be also contributing to our food, because, one, it's the most beautiful thing to actually grow food, and that process and helping food come emerge from the ground and making the soil rich enough for that to happen is a very restorative process for ourselves. But also it sort of reduces the burden of letting everyone else create that food for yourself, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've gone down a rabbit hole about food, but back to architecture, I guess. Do you have any advice for our practice? Because there's not a cynical bone in the design team. We're all very keen to do more sustainable design, but we seem to be stuck in everyday land a little bit, and we tend to be pulled, like, it's almost like resisting gravity towards customer needs. And there's a hard reality to that, because you have to satisfy your customers, otherwise you can't feed yourself. So how do we escape that vortex? Because we've talked so many times about doing more, and yet we seem stuck in a little bit of a groundhog day of always having good intention. but never really taking the next step as a practice in evolving to be a champion of sustainability and a greener solutions, I guess.
So what would I recommend? I mean, I don't know. I was asked the other day about what five top things would you recommend for a house. So let me sort of go through those. First of all, I think this is the decade where we've really got to make significant reductions in CO2 emissions. And when I say significant, I mean significant. And that kind of means every single ton counts. So as embodied energy is a great big upfront lump of carbon, I think right at the moment we should be concentrating on renovating rather than rebuilding, you know, rather than knocking down and rebuilding and whole new places. I just think we need to be, rather than going, oh, it's not economical, it's not easy, is to sort of say, well, even which parts of the existing home can we really reuse and maybe lose some of it and salvage those materials for reuse, because we've got to start valuing the embodied carbon of every single piece of material. Plus also it's got cultural heritage. It's got a whole lot of things. So I think that's number one. The second one is to really dematerialize and simplify. We don't need a lot of space. We need quality space. And we don't need a lot of stuff and finishes. So when we dematerialize, like, we need to ask, do I really need this? Do I really need this extra space? Do I really need this extra finish? So that then when we do get down to that, we then ideally let those healthy, necessary materials express themselves and bring life into the home. The third one is, which is really kind of simple, is make your home as airtight as possible. We have got some of the leakiest homes in the world, which just means totally uncontrolled energy flow. And if we do seal up, we've also got to address ventilation, but there's so much, you've got to go a long way before you're going to suffocate yourself. The next one is insulate wherever possible, like insulate your walls and ceilings and make your windows and doors operate better so that they're not, you know, either do a secondary glazing or put curtains and other things, because you're just losing energy. And then the fifth one is just collaborate with your garden to create a place of delight for you and other species, along with summer, you know, shade in summer whilst letting in sun in winter, and just creating delight that is outside of the four walls of your home, and either on your balcony or in your garden, or even if you're on your street if you haven't got a big garden. But I just sort of think that it's actually not super complicated things we need to be doing. It's almost going paring back and doing less much better.
And I think that's a really great summary. And I think I'll definitely share it with the team. And particularly, I mean, we have some of the worst windows in the world. Like, they're just terrible. And I speak to people who have come from Eastern Europe, even Russia, and they're going, I can't believe your windows, because wind whistles straight through them. And so
they're made of aluminium that transfer heat faster than the glass.
Yeah. Well, that's the least of your worries when winds just move, when you've actually got air. And one of the things that I see again and again is when you have an image of a potential new development with the window that was drawn into the picture, and then you have the actual window as delivered, and they're just awful clunky to begin with. And it comes down to budget. Like, the windows, been lucky enough to always use a premium window installer and be very uncompromising with windows. As much as they're aluminium, they're sealed well. But
if they need to be thermally broken if they're aluminium. But the other thing is that if you've got a budget for windows, then have less windows. Yeah. Don't have worse windows. Have less windows.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? But it's a tough sell. I mean, because we kind of know that, and yet our clients, and I guess driven by market forces generally, like to have a nice big set of doors opening to the garden, because and I guess where we do most of our work, what that means is that your living zone feels much bigger than it actually is because it opens right up onto the garden.
I agree, but there's questions about how big is big enough and how big is too big. And yeah, if you're fighting a budget, then you've got to start to really ask that question of, do I really need it? And what do I really need? Because I totally agree that connection with outdoors can enable a smaller interior space because you're borrowing the space of the outdoors. But, you know, I think the Japanese have got a much more conservative approach to sizes of windows and where you place them and how you do it. And I just think they need to be carefully thought through.
Yeah. One of my conundrums is I know aircon is a much more efficient way of heating, but oh my God, I love floor heat. Like it's just such a nicer feeling because it doesn't feel like you're heating the space. The space is just at a steady temperature. So is it possible to have floor heat and be sustainable, or is it really a juncture that where you're one or the other?
I just think again it gets to, and I think what we're all going to start doing is doing life cycle assessments of our building. I think we're going to be required to. And that's going to quickly put a carbon number on two systems for heating and cooling. And if you're only allowed X number of tons of carbon for your building, right, then you'll say, gosh, maybe I need to give up one of these because I can't have that much embodied carbon in my building. And then you'll say, well, which one will do it better for me in this place? And if you can use that, I mean, the good thing about air conditioning is it can very quickly heat and cool a space. But if you use a hydronic floor so that you can heat it and cool it, but it's a much slower and longer thing, and that depends on your lifestyle and the people living there. But I would suggest having both is probably an overkill. Having recommended both to clients of mine in the past, I'm just, you know, again, I'm learning that there's actually, we all need to have embodied carbon targets and budgets, and we need to be thinking about this because every ton counts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's one of those conundrums where, like, we feel it, but we feel pressure. There's definitely, I mean, because I tell you why, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is really listening to clients. Like that's something that I found that, well, coincidentally helps us, I guess, sell our services. But if you really listen to clients, so we're sort of in this, we're always torn. We're always between trying to promote more sustainable living, more lower embodied carbon. But I guess we've got this other pressure of clients who just want, who love bricks and concrete and want double bricks, for example. Like, you know, so how do you gently steer clients around their preconceptions without kind of going, or how do you bring them there without making it seem like you're not listening? Like what's the Jedi trick that you've got?
Well, I mean, and this is something I'm working on because I haven't, you know, like I literally haven't sort of been designing a house for a number of years because I've gone into being more strategic. So it's not a current problem I'm personally dealing with, but I'm hearing and working with a number of architects who are. And I think that the way forward is going to be that we will be having targets for embodied carbon. We'll be having targets for operational carbon that we can use. And I think that what we need to be talking to our clients about is, why are these targets being set? And they're being set because Australia has made a commitment with the rest of the world to try and make sure that the temperatures of the world do not rise more than 1.5 degrees. The current dystopian climate we're already experiencing is only at 1.1 degrees Celsius. So 1.5, you'd think, is about the maximum you'd want to get to. And at the moment, we're spiraling off to 3 or 4 degrees. And I don't know how we live in a climate like that. So if we say it's up to all of us to help do this, and what's been determined as a good target then for your home is this amount of carbon to help us all achieve that, then this is where we're at. So we're going to help you get the best possible place for you within that target, and that means we need to make some decisions. So let's work together to make the best decisions.
Yeah, I hear, but
it's a tough sell.
It's a tough sell. It's absolutely a tough sell because...
But that's why it's going to become regulated, because people on their own don't choose to maybe take that route and they say, well, someone else can sort it out. Well, there is no someone else. It's us.
And so are we wasting our time? Should we just wait? Should we just follow the regulation? Are we wasting our breath?
No, because you're trying to... I don't believe that you're someone who waits to be told what to do. I think most... good people want to be ahead of the regulation. They can see that it's coming and they say, well, I'm going to be in front of that, because regulation is there because below that are people who are basically being, you know, criminals. They're not doing the right thing. Now, you don't want to be there. Like, you don't want to be on the border, and you don't want your clients to be on the border, and you want to be setting them up to have houses that in the future, when mandatory disclosure for energy efficiency comes on board, that their house isn't some white elephant that's sitting there really hard to sell or rent, but that is very much retaining its value because it's really been designed well and it is efficient.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the real, I guess, one way or another, you've got to lead them to where there's either a benefit or a downside down the track. And I guess that's the key for us, is trying to point them to the fact that they're doing something that makes sense today, but maybe won't make a lot of sense in a few years, even in resale, because nobody's going to want to live in that, or whoever buys that house is going to be thinking, I've got to do a bit of work to make that more energy efficient. So I don't know. I feel like maybe we should all always take it back to the hip pocket, I guess, somehow.
Yeah, but I think also sort of being part of creating the future that will support your kids and grandkids, I think we've got to heighten that opportunity for people to be part of the group that helps shape how that can be a good place to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And be part of, you know. I think most people are they want to make a beautiful home for them and their family. Now, if the definition of a beautiful home is now including how it's home, it's going to enable the human race to continue into the future, then that's part of that description. And how can they be a really constructive part of showing that you can do that and not impact the future so badly, you know? In fact, even regeneratively do good and make it better.
And I guess one of the things that we try and do on Buildopedia is really break through some of the myths and the misconceptions, and maybe like some of the people, you know, we're always trying to think of things that everyone knows that are actually not quite right. So what are some of the misconceptions about sustainability? What are the things that everyone is thinking that are actually not true or not quite right?
Well, two of the ones that annoy me, that it's more expensive. So I would say, well, what's your budget and how do you build the right building for that budget? Maybe you don't have three bathrooms. Maybe you have one or one and a half. Maybe you don't have, you know, 80 square meters of windows and doors, you have 60. And then you make sure that every bit of building material is doing more than one thing, so that you need less, you know, that dematerialization thing. I mean, maybe you don't, that if you do use brick walls because you like, you know, that solidity, that you just either leave them exposed or you paint them. You don't put plaster on them. Is the plaster necessary? Maybe if you do want a concrete slab, that you take it as a concrete slab. You don't tile it or put anything on it because, you know, that's extra material, extra carbon, and extra cost, that you kind of embed all of those ideas of, and but then you make sure it's beautifully done, and you accept the cracks, and you just work with that palette of materials and make sure that all of those decisions are not making it more expensive, because they are inherent there, that they're providing a floor, they're providing thermal mass, they're providing a finished product. And so therefore you can't just take that out because it's inherent to the whole thing. So I think that if you can say, oh, that's, I'm going to pull that out, it's an add-on and it's not integrated into the design, and therefore it can. But I think those discussions around budget, and I think the budget hasn't to be more than just the built budget, but the operational budget as well, and just to really shape the building from an early stage so that they can really understand what expensive is. You know, a great big house on the edge of town where it costs you a lot of money to drive everywhere and operate it, that's not expensive, you know. So whereas a small place more locally where you actually use common facilities like libraries and local parks and other things, you can live in a smaller space, but you can live a larger life less impactfully. The other thing that annoys me a bit is the idea that a smart home where you have a button that does everything and you don't even have to know what's happening, you know, there's a computer that runs your home for you. To me, that's a really dumb home because you're not doing anything. And I think that we need to engage with what's happening during the day, during the seasons, because that is healthy for us and our bodies to interact more positively with the outer world. And then if we can then go, gosh, it's going to be a hot day today, I'm going to close everything down in my house so it's not going to overheat, or it's going to be a really beautiful sunny day in winter, let's open it up and maximize the amount of energy we can soak up during the day, then that is a good thing for you and a good thing for, you know, how you will live in your home. And that's smart.
And I don't have any data on this, but what if I said maybe there's evidence that a smart home is more energy efficient? Would you then change your mind? Because people have habits, people forget things. Like people are busy, and you know they're getting their kids ready for school, going to work. They're doing things. So if there was evidence that a smart home,
well, I'd love to know how much energy a smart home, all of those dibs and dabs, use.
Yeah.
Because I'm not convinced, you know, if you're running every blind on energy, if you're opening and closing things with power, there's a whole lot of embodied energy getting that to happen, and then a whole lot of operational energy to make it happen. Whereas opening and shutting blinds by hand is very energy efficient.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't know the answer. I'm very curious. Yeah.
There might be a hybrid solution that one or two things might be on a circuit and other things you do yourself, because I just think there's also a beautiful day. I just think that connectedness of us and our home and the weather is a really important thing to develop an understanding of what is happening, and to see, find our agency in making our homes as comfortable as possible by understanding and working with that.
I think one of the problems is that the technology hasn't been there to make them smart enough. But I guess the reality is that you're not always home, and if there is a cool change and all your windows are shut because it's been a hot day, and you know, maybe a smart home could cool your house like naturally before you got home. But I've always found that, and I've built a lot of houses over the years with a lot of automation, and really it's never been that great. It's never been as good as promised. But I can see, you know, things like, I mean, the thing that I love is being able to leave your house and hit one button to turn all the lights off. Because you're like, if you've got, I've got four kids, there's always some light on somewhere. So unless you wander through the house and switch them all off. It's just one of those things.
I think the kill all the unnecessary power button is a great one. You know, yeah. That's what I mean, that hybrid thing, that as you either go to bed or leave, you can hit one button and all the unnecessary power points and lights can just be turned off in one go. That's a good thing, I think.
And just on another sort of tangent, I mean, what are the secrets to making sustainable homes look like a great piece of architecture? Because for a lot of architects, it seems to be like a choice of one or the other. But I'm kind of wondering what's the secret to great architecture? And I know you've mentioned a few of these, but if you've got any trade secrets to reveal.
Yeah, look, what is great art? What does looking great look like? And I think that's a very subjective thing. And I think that we probably need to talk about this more, because to me, a house that is patently overly large, overly complicated, which means a huge amount of embodied energy, I know those houses get into magazines and sort of everyone goes, wow, look at that. But for me at the moment, in this time, I look at that and feel sick, because I'm just seeing that one group of people is consuming more than is available for the average person, and that's not okay. So when I see a really simple, beautiful home that is really working with the place it's in and the garden around it and creating comfortable, lovely spaces with natural materials beautifully expressed, I look at that and go, that is beautiful. That is good design. So I think our definition of what is good design might be changing as we kind of move away from design that is overly consumptive and greedy. And people go, oh, well, it's not up to us, you know, let's decarbonize the energy system, let's decarbonize the transport system and all of that. 23% of CO2 emissions in Australia come from our buildings.
Yeah.
So it is a big bit. And, you know, it's a bit like saying, someone said, you know, it's a bit like, oh, I'm only one drop of water, I can't make a difference. Well, many drops of water make up a river, and a river can be very impactful.
And I think something like 9% of the world's emissions is concrete, like just that one building material, if I've remembered correctly. But
yeah, look, they're all over the place. You know, I don't know. I've read that 11% of carbon emissions in the world is embodied carbon. So, you know, that would be concrete, steel, aluminium, a whole bunch of things. So I don't know. It's a bit tricky, but let's just say it's significant.
And it's significant.
Let's just say that everyone counts. And to say it's someone else's responsibility, I don't know how you rationalize that with your kids in the future when they say, so what did you do when there was an option to do something differently? How did you respond, Dad?
You're making me feel terrible now. I'm going to cry. As a professional group, do you think architects as a group of people are doing enough?
I think some are doing a lot and others are thinking they're doing a lot but not really, and then there's a whole lot who aren't doing anything because they don't think that they have the agency to do that. They can't, or they don't believe they should do anything. So I think it is... You know, there was this whole Architects Declare movement that started in Australia in 2019, and we've got over close to 1,200 practices that have signed up for that. And that's not 1,200 people, that's 1,200 practices, some of which have got hundreds of architects in it. So I'm thinking there's, you know, maybe 10,000 architects who are going, this is really important. There really is a climate and biodiversity emergency, and we as a profession have an enormous role to play in making things better so that we're part of the solution, we're not part of the problem. But I think that we do need to do things differently, and I think people are kind of struggling to say, well, how do we do that and how do we change the whole profession or the, not the profession, the whole built environment sector, because it's a big group of people to bring along. You know, there's engineers, there's builders, there's planners, there's all sorts of people. So there is work in progress and there's lots of people doing some interesting and good things, but I just think we need to go faster in a sense on that.
And do you think, I guess, because I raise this with you and we promise not to name anyone, but you know, some of the signatories to Architects Declare are still delivering a hell of a lot of concrete in their buildings. Are they just, is Architects Declare for them just something, you know, akin to a bit of greenwashing? Is that happening, or do you think?
Have you heard of the Three Horizons framework?
No. Tell us about the Three Horizons.
Okay, there's the current horizon, which is not proving up to the game and eventually will fade out. The middle horizon might be this disruptive thing that might help change that one, and it'll come and it'll go. And then down here is a third horizon, which is the future, and it will emerge. And often the three of them are that they are all in play at the same time, because you can't just suddenly stop doing what you're doing and just start doing this. But I think you've got to be in play to be putting in place things for the second and third horizon to be nurtured and brought into play. And concrete per se is, I mean, there is a lot of work being done on creating concrete with less embodied carbon, and some, you know, are even trying to do concrete that consumes carbon in its production. I'm not sure, but, you know, like I know the last project I worked on with this, we went through a whole episode. Do we do a concrete floor or should we be doing a timber floor? And we really pulled this apart. And in the end, we went with a concrete floor because we realized that it would do many things. One of the most important things, it would actually provide really good termite barrier that would meant that all the timber we used on top wouldn't have to be treated. It's not a home, but so it didn't have to be treated. Two, in its raw form, we didn't need another topping. We didn't need another layer, so that therefore we could really dematerialize the place. And then it would also bring really good beneficial thermal mass into the building, which we could really see the benefit of. And then fourthly, we then worked with the local concrete people to work out how to reduce the emissions, not only for this building but for every other building. So we did go with the concrete slab, but we didn't just leave it at that. And the builder was sensational in making sure that, you know, the benefits of working with those concrete people are widely spread.
And I mean, concrete's fantastic. It's I guess that's the conundrum. It's so enduring as a finish, and there's almost, yeah, there wouldn't be an architect who doesn't love concrete in some way. Mm. So that is a conundrum, because it's hugely carbon intensive to mine the material and create and deliver concrete, but then it's enduring. So you've got this conundrum of. So I feel like you've got this overlay of competing ideas where one's enduring, so maybe we should build it because it'll last forever. Well, not forever, but, you know, a long time. And then one's less carbon intent or less embodied carbon, and then one performs better. So how do you bring all those elements together?
But I think if you say I'm going to use it, then you really optimize its benefits. So you don't go and put carpet on it, because the thermal qualities will be removed from the room. And then you're putting a heap more embodied carbon because you're putting underlay and then carpet. You know, so you sort of say, well, if I am going to use it, I'm only going to use it where I need to use it, and where its benefit will be as great as possible.
I guess, Caroline, you can fill us in with three key takeaways. I think one of the key takeaways is I feel terrible about myself, about what I'm going to tell my children.
That's negative. I think the first one is we all have more agency than we think, and we should step into it.
Yep.
In so much parts of our lives. And I also think that we need to really learn to live simply so that others can, so that we can all simply live in the future. I think that when we really realize we are part of nature, not separate, then the need to address, to make that our whole ecosystem thrive will become easily and more apparent to us as we choose what we do.
I'm going to just wrap up by asking, because do you ever think that, like, because you get the sense, I get the sense that no matter almost what we do, it's not enough. Do you ever get down about, like, do you ever think maybe all this is futile because it might be too late?
Well, I think it is possible to go down that pathway, and then you've got to stop yourself and come back, because if everyone thought like that, it would be futile. And the idea is that you've got to try and bring more people along to say, together we can do this, together we are going to do this, and let's work out how we're going to do that, because we can. It isn't too late. And it's only too late if everyone says it's too late and I can't do anything, or I don't feel like it, or it's too hard. And it's not. And it's important. It's important not to fail. It's too important not to fail.
Well, look, I think that's a great, great spot to finish. And Caroline, thank you so much. It's been brilliant having you on. I really appreciate your time. And thank you for joining us. And it's been a bit of a long time coming, but appreciate your patience, and thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
A pleasure, and I'm you know, wish you all the best in not giving up and achieving a little bit better each time quickly.
Well, whenever that happens, I'm going to ring you, and then, you know, I'll feel bad for a time, and then you can build me back up.
Okay, no worries.
Thank you, Carol.
You've been listening to Buildapedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildapedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.